I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Here's a fact that I honestly have to say out loud over and over again because I really kind of have trouble believing it's real. But Americans waste 40% of all the food we produce. It's true, that figure comes from actual research. And before we go and blame our famously broken food system for all that waste, the fact is that people throwing out food at home is a huge contributor to that. So I think we need to think about how to lighten that load. Because food waste is obviously money waste, but it's also a strain on the environment to produce that food in the first place, and a strain to deal with all that rotting food afterwards. And a lot of people are trying to tackle this issue by turning to chefs. And it makes sense, right? They're always cutting waste because it's basically the only way to make a profit running a restaurant. And they're experts at making things delicious, but chefs also often come up with ideas that require a team of prep cooks, or you know, they end up making those kale stems into a great finishing sprinkle for the sweetbreads on their tasting menu, but not, you know, something for dinner at home on Tuesday. So let me introduce you to Abra Behrens.
Hi!
Oh.
It's so nice to see you.
It's so good to see you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me over. I'm so excited to be in your place.
Thanks for coming through.
Abra is absolutely one of my favorite people on earth. She grew up in rural Michigan, was a farmer, and is now a chef on a farm, and the author of the beautiful new cookbook called Roughage. And while she was in New York promoting that book, which, full disclosure, I wrote the foreword for because I love her so much, I asked her to come over and go through my fridge. I wanted to learn from her and see how to know what's still fresh, you know, how to salvage the so-so stuff, and how to know when it's time to just move on and not feel too bad about it.
All right, so we're talking fridges and pantries and food waste. Is that what we're talking about today? All right, great. You know I love not wasting stuff.
Okay, when I talk to a lot of chefs about, you know, minimizing food waste, this is a thing that chefs are really into, a lot of chefs are really into. Mm-hmm. It's great, and then the next part of the conversation is, oh yeah, so you would just take like the pulp from the carrot juice, and then you lacto-ferment it, and then you dehydrate it, and after that you pulverize it, and then you rehydrate it again and make a twirl out of it. It's delicious.
Yeah, it's so easy.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, that's awesome. That sounds great.
Yeah.
But you don't come at it like that.
Yeah, I tend to think about it a little bit more like, what can you do to avoid the waste from the get-go? So if that means, you know, buying in smaller quantities and more frequently, or buying a mixture of things that some are going to go bad sooner, like really delicate, beautiful microgreens and baby greens, and then having kale and then cabbage, you know, like those have different shelf lives. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So trying to have a good product mix in your own fridge. Mm. But then also how to like kind of read the landscape of the food and be like, oh, that's starting to like turn that little bit of a color where it's still good, but it needs to happen in the next couple of days. Right. And really have kind of the things on hand to be able to turn those into meals quickly so that you can catch that window before it expires is a funny word because expiration dates are a whole nother can of worms or whatever. But, you know, I think that's another element of mitigating waste is relying on your senses to tell you what you're looking at.
Rather than a date stamp on the package.
Right, because you have, there's all so many variables in that. And also you have to think about it from the person who's stamping that date on the package. Their primary thing is that nobody gets something that's not fresh, but it also doesn't mean that it's an indicator of going bad. Mm. When I used to work at the produce market, they would never sell milk that was within, you know, a week of the expiration. But milk lasts for weeks past the expiration. So a lot of times the cafe could absorb that, turn it into ricotta and use it up until that date, and then it wouldn't go to waste. Right. And so I think, you know, in a home kitchen where you don't have some of those same scale and infrastructure issues, it's still important to utilize your senses. Because really, we all understand when food has gone bad. We might just have to like reacquaint ourselves with some of those hallmarks. And there are significantly worse things in the world than having some sour milk in your mouth. So like taste your milk, and if it tastes bad, spit it out. Yeah. And then start
and then
again.
You know it's done.
And then you know it's bad. All right, okay. So let's look through your fridge.
Yeah, so this is super fun. I had a full fridge prepared for you. I had a compost bucket. We're gonna go through it. You're gonna tell me, oh my God, you can actually cook the cauliflower leaves. They're delicious.
Yeah.
My wife, Christine.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful woman.
It is not her job to clean the kitchen and the fridge. It's my job. Uh-huh. So I don't expect her to do it. Uh-huh. And she decided 2 days ago that she wanted to clean the kitchen and the fridge.
Oh, man. It's like an O. Henry story. Like a Gifts of the Magi in the kitchen.
Like the opposite.
Totally. I think this is a blessing in disguise because I think so many times people get fixated on like, how do I turn this like drippy bag of like swamp greens into something delicious? And it's like, well, you don't really. but there's lots of things that are maybe on the edge. Or even just thinking about, like, we always call it vegetable triage at our house, or like fridge triage, like what things need to like have some attention paid right away and which ones can continue to sit in the back. So I think Christine has given us a leg up on the conversation. Yeah.
All right. All right. Let's open her up.
Okay. This is so fun and also sort of voyeuristic. I mean, it's like half the time when I'm catering in people's homes, there's like this moment of like, let's see how they organize things. Great. So I think. Well, first of all, it's a very well-organized fridge, Francis. Lots of good Tupperware choices that are all square, so easy to stack. What is this? Is this
oatmeal?
That's
my daughter's oatmeal. Don't judge.
Okay. We'll leave
that.
She
didn't eat a lot this morning.
Great. All right. Oh, my God. What's this guy? Herb salsa. I'm going to go into the veggie thing. So you've got one scallion.
This scallion is not the color God intended.
It's, no, but it's also
it's
well, actually,
pale green. It's not quite like yellow brown.
Yeah, let's pull that out. Let's. Oh, here, there's more scallions.
Yeah, so I got fresh scallions because of this sad single scallion.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm gonna shut the fridge door for energy efficiency's sake. Okay, so let's look at what we've got here. So yeah, you've got two different batches, and if you're looking at these two different scallions, what you can see is that the ones that are fresher, you said you bought these just recently, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. They're straighter and they have crisper greens. There's no like signs of like denting or whatever along the root. The roots are still really nice and firm. So like these guys I would not think that much about. Whereas on the guy that's a little bit older in the fridge, it has gone from that bright green to more of a gray. So that's kind of how you can tell what you're looking at. And food will tell you what it's trying to tell you. And you know, vegetables especially, they're agricultural products and they are alive in a lot of ways without making it too like philosophical. You know, they should look enticing and bright and alive. And so when it starts to kind of move away from that, it's a good indicator to like, let's get it going a little bit.
Get on using it.
Mm-hmm. And so what I would do with this one that's a little bit older is also pulling off some of the older ends. Mm-hmm. You can trim it up a little bit. I would also probably just add this to your herb salsa because you already have a jar of some herbs that are chopped up and probably, I would guess,
there's
like
vinegar.
Olive. Yeah. And so that way you know that it's going to get used up. And like a lot of that is also kind of restaurant stuffing of like you're going through your containers and taking something that's in a really big container, putting it into a smaller one. What things can you combine like items together, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's what I would do with these guys.
I love that.
And then the other things I pulled out, you've got one apple that I think is it's feeling really, really good. Like it feels nice and firm. There's no obvious like blemishes or marks or anything like that. And again, sometimes I like to think about it like what is the plant trying to do? And so when you have a blemish in a piece of fruit, it's trying to heal that wound because it knows that's an entrance point for either bacteria or pests or something like that. And so the more perfect a fruit is, the longer it's going to last. And so I then use them in the inverse order. So if you have some apples that you notice like, oh, there's a couple of marks on this one, still totally good. There's a ton of food there, but use them first.
Yeah.
And then also I find it really helpful to have a handful of recipes for things that can kind of hoover up a lot of those things. So for me with fruit, that can be like a roasted fruit compote or something like that. And you can even freeze them too. We would do that at one of the restaurants where I worked where we had fruit salad in the cafe. And then whatever fruit salad came back after, you know, 2 or 3 hours, because the fruit at some point starts to look a little weird, then we would either freeze it or just start those batches of compote.
Yeah.
And that was a really fun one.
And literally just throw in the oven?
Yeah, throw in the oven or on the stovetop. The one that we did that I love doing with apples specifically or cranberries in the fall is make a caramel and then like a pretty dark like smoking caramel and then add the fruit to it. But you can do it with just regular sugar too and just let it cook down until it's thick and soft and then cool it and pop it in your fridge or in your freezer And that can be a really fast way to do dessert, or spoon like a frozen little bit of fruit compote over yogurt or over pancakes or whatever. You know, you can use it in anything. It's also really good if you take a fruit compote and add mustard to it, and put that with like charcuterie or cheeses or some of that, or like on sandwiches, like turkey sandwiches or ham sandwiches or whatever, with that kind of like mustardy fruitiness. I really love that. So that's what I would say about fruit. And then the other thing I pulled out is these carrots. And there's sort of two ways to look at some of the root crops. So the more recently that they've been pulled out of the ground, they're gonna have their greens on them still. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times at stores, you can get roots that have the greens or that don't. And I don't have any sort of value association difference with them. It's just a different characteristic. So for your carrots, they've been pulled from the ground for a little while, but they're still nice and firm. And if you have the greens will also respirate moisture from the roots more quickly because they have more surface area, and that's sort of how the plant functions. So if you have a root that still has the greens attached and you're gonna store them, like if you're not gonna have them in the next couple of days, take the greens off. You can store them separately if you wanna use them. I actually don't generally do that much with the carrot greens, partially because I have access to compost, and so it alleviates my guilt of throwing them away. But also, they're a really intense flavor, and I found when I was like super into some of those like more elaborate things, carrot top pesto and things like that, you had to buy so much parsley and so much basil to like make them palatable because they're so tannic. So sometimes I think it's reasonable, especially in a home kitchen, if you know that you're not going to make carrot top pesto, which I often don't. I don't usually buy carrots with the tops on. So the only thing I would say about these carrots is that you're getting a little bit of root development. It's trying to root. So carrots and all root crops, they store all of this energy in their roots in order to send up a new sprout. Okay. So like carrots are biennial. So they grow the first year, put all of their energy into making this thick taproot, store the nutrients.
Which is what we think of as the carrot.
Yes. Okay. Store the nutrients there, and then they'll go through a winter cycle, and then in the spring, they'll send up a flower shoot to set seed. So all plants are trying to set seed. That's their like primary goal. So if you have carrots, they go into cold storage and then they go into like a warmer place in your kitchen. You'll get all of these like little tiny hairy roots coming out because it's spring. I should be like sending up my flower shoot.
Oh, that's what's happening.
Isn't that wild? Like plants are so cool. But that's also why carrots get sweeter after the frost, because they've put all this energy into their taproot and they're converting that starch into sugar to feed that shoot when it comes up. And then the increase of sugar also means that they won't freeze as easily, which it's like
amazing.
Isn't it amazing? I just love it. Yeah. And the same is true for parsnips, which is why if people say, oh, I don't eat parsnips because they're so bitter, it's because they haven't gone through, because parsnips are like sinister little buggers, because they they are so bitter, because also that bitterness is a natural pest deterrent. They will like taste really bitter until they go through that frost, and then they'll start to sweeten. The other thing that parsnips do, and the reason you don't see parsnips with their leaves on them, is that they secrete a chemical that literally will burn you, because they're trying to not disturb the like taproot. It's wild.
It's like a self-defense thing.
Totally. And then so that's root crops. So general rule of thumb, store separate from the greens, only buy the greens if you think you're gonna use them. And then what you're looking for is any sign of that sort of regrowth. And also to remember, like there's this one spot on this carrot that's like, probably had like a little divot, probably had like a gash when it was being forked from harvest, little bit of, like kind of that downy mold that happens just from being in plastic in refrigeration. Mm-hmm. But 98% of this carrot is totally great. So like just cut that little bit off. But also because it's not soft, it's not like wiggly or any of those things, there's not a ton of urgency around that. But if you were to if you were to find like a slippery one in there, give them a rinse, give them a smell. And if they're starting to feel soft, then I would get them into a pan. Yeah.
That's Abra Behrens. She's the author of Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables, and we'll have more with her after the break. And later, we meet a yogurt maker, betting the farm on whey, as in curds and whey, being the next big thing. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for Curious Cooks and Eaters. And we're back with my dear friend, the farmer, chef, and writer, Abra Behrens. She has a new book called Roughage, and she has been rifling through my fridge to teach us the truth about shelf life and how to make easy meals with what you need to use up.
Should we talk about some of the things you like to do when you have just like bits and bobs of whatever in the fridge? You mentioned earlier, oh, if you have fruit, you like to just roast the fruit or put them in a caramel and cook them down. And that can be a great like chunky sauce for ice cream or something.
Yeah.
But talk about what you would do if you were in your fridge and you had like half a cup of cauliflower left and a quarter cup of eggplant left.
So I tend to, I make a lot of frittatas, mostly because we have a ton of eggs in our house always. I generally make a big batch at once, so I'll use a dozen eggs, crack them into a container, and then top it up with either milk or cream to until you get to about a quart total volume. Add a bunch of salt, and then heat up a frying pan and add all of the random vegetables, and that can be everything from the roasted cauliflower, the bits of eggplant. You can use up greens, so it's a really great way if you've got some greens that are kind of on the edge to do like spinach in there, kale, probably not the lettuces, although you could try and see what and but like chard or the beet tops, all of that sort of stuff, and then just pour the egg over the top. I usually keep it on the burner until that bottom part is set, and then I'll finish it in the oven, so it's just like a nice egg bake, and then you know you have that for breakfast. The other thing I really love is I do a lot of shaved vegetable salads, where I'll take all of those random ends, and then you could take your carrot and just shave it with a vegetable peeler or a knife. And this is another thing I love is we call it trashy ranch in our house. And it's like equal parts pickle juice from the jar, so after you've eaten all the pickles, and then mayonnaise, and just shake it up into a like really nice dressing. It's like super tangy. You can do it with sauerkraut juice. You could do it with kimchi juice. Anything that's like really acidic in that way.
It's incredible.
So good. Yeah, I know. And it sounds so ridiculous, but it's really good. And then I'll just take all of those vegetable things, dress it in trashy ranch, maybe add some herbs to it if you have it, and serve that with like anything.
And you have a whole thing in your book about stocking your pantry, to have things on hand. So you can make quick salads, quick things, you toss something with a dressing and that makes a meal.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite things?
Well, I think the things that I go to the most to make those fast dinners out of what we have are sometimes, I mean, there's the pantry staples like a can of chickpeas. I love oil packed tuna. And the reason I like it in the oil is because then it, you have like tuna flavored oil that you can use in your dressing. So I really love that. I also always have chili oil on hand, which is, I make a very simple version where you just toast, fry the chilies, and just like the ones you'd get at a pizza place, like the crushed red pepper, fry those up in like kind of, you know, maybe a half inch or so of, and I use neutral oil because I'm sort of cheap, and so I don't always want to use nice olive oil when it's just going to be spicy and all those things. So I'll use a neutral oil, deep fry them in that, and then take it off the heat and add the cold oil to stop the cooking. And then it sort of steeps in that way. It becomes bright red and really beautiful, and we spoon that over so many things. And then also another sort of food waste ender on both ends is roasted cherry tomatoes. We do that a lot at the farm. You take all of these cherry tomatoes, toss them in a little bit of oil that I do use olive oil for, olive oil, salt, maybe some pepper, maybe some chili flakes if you want to, and then put them in the oven at like 350 and roast them until they get to nappe, which is where the liquid will burst and then it'll reduce slowly. And when you can drag a wooden spoon or a spatula across the bottom and it, the liquid doesn't rush in on itself. And then I freeze that. And you could probably can it, but I never have because I never like get the whole canning rigmarole out. Yeah, I mean, I wish
you
that
grew
I
up
did,
country. Yeah. You don't need to pretend to be country anymore. You
yeah.
have a freezer.
We
now.
Bought a freezer. Yeah. So, and I think, and that's the thing. It's like I don't want to be dismissive of it because for a lot of people, they're reconnecting with those things, and that's valuable. And if you have the time and the interest to do it, great. Like, you know, but as soon as you feel beholden to it or it becomes an impediment to enjoying your food, that feels like a real bummer. And I also think that about food waste too, that for me, it's really important to honor the work that went into and the resources that went into producing this food.
Sure.
But also like, you know, if you've got a really crazy week and you have to throw something out, it's okay.
Don't stress yourself out.
Yeah, and don't beat yourself up over it, too, is a big part of it. But I do think the side benefit of people thinking about food waste is, you know, when you care about something, it's often because we value it. And so I think that as a society, our study will only improve the more we care about the food that we consume, how it's produced, the people who are doing that production. Mm-hmm. And I think the simplest way to show that you care is by not throwing it out.
When you don't have to.
Right, when you don't have to, yeah. Exactly, perfect. Yeah. And so just thinking about it that way, yeah.
Thank you, Abra.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much for having me.
That was Abra Behrens, and she is the author of Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables. You can find her recipe for carrots with spicy apricot jam, mint, and almonds, and some of her other ways to use carrots at splendidtable.org. About 10 years ago, Homa Dashtaki was laid off from her dream job, and she was not in a good place. Her father was dealing with the death of his brother, and basically to keep themselves preoccupied so they wouldn't dwell on their sadness, they started making yogurt together. They strained it so it was thick and rich, and that yogurt became the basis for Homa's company, White Mustache. It's become a cult favorite with magazines like Bon Appetit singing its praises. While White Mustache was going supersonic with stores lining up to carry it, Homa realized that she didn't feel totally great about all her success. Because the more yogurt she made, the more she just kept thinking about the byproduct, the liquid whey that she was pouring down the drain. Now, yogurt whey is a tangy, nutritious, probiotic liquid that people use all around the world, apparently, except for here. So she decided to stop growing her company until she could figure out a way to sell the whey. And it's become more complicated than she ever realized it would be. We visited her, we went into her factory, inside the room where the magic happens, where the cultures turn milk into yogurt.
So Homa, thank you so much for having us on White Mustache.
My pleasure, thanks for coming.
We are in your vat room.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we look at here are these two vats. They're 80 gallons each?
Yeah, they're 80 gallons each. And while they may seem enormous, you know, you have the option of going up to 200 gallon batch or like larger. And I've chosen to have two going because like this is my max size that I'm gonna operate at.
Yeah.
Because I think that yogurt tastes different when there's like more probiotics or they have like a bigger like space to like
to grow in.
Yeah. I think there's like some dry tanniny thing that happens in your mouth actually. So this room is built to make many small batches, which is kind of our business model, I guess, or our MO.
Yeah. How did you get into making yogurt?
Totally by accident. Like I was an attorney. I got laid off and then I'm such a cliche, and then I tried to like find myself and it's like a very boring story. But then like I started making yogurt because it's the one thing like my dad always did at home that I took for granted and I didn't even value.
Mm.
And we just found ourselves at a place in life where we were both bored. I was unemployed. I was living with my parents at like 30 something. It was like pathetic. Mm. And I was like, let's just go to farmers markets and like do this and like have a way to spend time. Me and my dad are like quite close. And it wasn't supposed to be a business. And then like when people tried our yogurt at the farmers markets, like their reaction was as if they'd never tried yogurt before. And this isn't something I like tried to go after or tried to create.
Yeah.
It's literally something I'd ignored my whole life. And my idea of success was like a very typical American idea of success. It was like to be a lawyer, to do well, to get into a good firm, to make money.
Sure.
And I had done all those things, and yet, like, you know, the irony is, like, this one part of my heritage that I ignored forever has actually given me the most amount of happiness and success. And like, it was all by accident, by trying to go to farmers markets and like hang out with my dad and like flirt with some boys. And like, that was the goal. And like our first farmers market, we made 12 bucks. And I was like, I think we're onto something here. It was totally by accident and very lucky.
And then I know there were some trials and tribulations. You had to move from California to New York because of regulatory issues, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
But I remember when I first saw White Mustache Yogurt here.
Uh-huh.
And I can't even say that it was I saw it. I heard about it because people were yelling at me. But I was like, oh my God, you have to try this yogurt. It's amazing. And it seemed like you were exploding. We could find your yogurt in fancy stores and then more stores around the city. But then you kind of decide to stop growing the business.
Yeah.
Why?
Many reasons. One was that growth trajectory that you just like explained was like a miracle. The fact that we were in existence was a miracle after all our trials and tribulations. The fact that like we're making this product that like to me feels like a miracle. And then like we're growing store after store after store all through word of mouth. Like I just felt very humbled by that in a way I've never felt humbled by anything before. Like I was like, this is bigger than me and it's not even about me. And like my only job is to take care of this thing. And
to take care of the milk.
To take care of the milk, even the brand, which is named after my dad, and like our heritage, which has informed how we make all of this. And like the cows that give us the milk, that give us this stuff. And when you're making yogurt in these relatively small batches and you're straining it and you have that pan of whey, and there's nowhere to put it, like it feels weird, it feels wrong. And traditionally we just drank it because there really isn't that much. Like you said, when you make it at home, you have a little bit and you either incorporate it right back in, you throw it out, or like we just would like shoot it because it was just like a nice refreshing little shot of yogurt water. Like, but now we're swimming in it as a company, you know? And it's like, what do you do with it? And I really thought I was like onto something. I was like, I'm just gonna put it in a bottle and like slap a label on here that says it's whey. And like, people are gonna love it. It's gonna be like the new Gatorade. And it was just like crickets, like radio silence, like no response. And like we were so spoiled with the success of our yogurt that I was like, no, this is a thing. And you know, we had hit capacity and I was like, okay, I can either grow more or I can dedicate the resources that we have back into the whey. And because our existence is so unique and the way White Mustache came into being feels very unique and very lucky, that I feel like we're more of an advocacy kind of company than a food company. And so in 2014, we capped our own production and we dedicated all our resources to finding a market for the whey. So then I realized the plain whey wasn't doing it, so I made flavored whey, which I mix it with just natural fruit juices. And then we just launched a line of popsicles last year as well, that just like is whey and fresh fruit.
But meanwhile, people are still like trying to pound down your door for more yogurt. Like, yeah. I'm standing in the vat room. There's clearly space for more vats in the vat room.
Yeah, but like that means more whey.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's my hurry? Like if I just take my time and figure this out, A, I really have solved like an amazing problem, but also like to me it doesn't seem like a problem. It's just like, hey everybody, I've got this really cool thing and like somebody needs to figure out what to do with it because it's going to be awesome. And I don't think it's going to be me. Like my job is just to make yogurt here.
But what's the deal with whey? Why does it matter to you? Like, why would you not just pour it down the drain?
Because it's still milk and there was such a process to get to it. I had to make the yogurt and then strain it. And then I have this like what I think of it, like a golden elixir. Like, it's water that was filtered through the grass, that was then filtered through the cow, that was then filtered through yogurt making.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can get this. Like, probiotic rich, full of calcium, vitamins, no calories, no fat, nothing. And I'm just like, huh. It's like, you know, I just think it's like the most special part of this whole process.
Can we taste the whey?
Yeah, please. Here is the plain whey straight up.
Okay. So it's almost, like you said, it's almost Gatorade looking.
Yep, almost Gatorade looking.
Not quite as garish as Gatorade, but it's got a unique yellowish tint. Okay, here we go. Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm a fan of plain yogurt, like on food and stuff. And so much of what I think of the flavor of yogurt, it's like purely crystallized in this way. Mm-hmm. It doesn't taste fatty, it doesn't taste sweet, but like the thing that makes the yogurt tangy, the thing that makes the yogurt feel like it has character, it's like purely crystallized in this drink.
But I think you've also managed to articulate why it doesn't resonate, because it's missed, like when you call it yogurt, the association is
creaminess, yeah.
And it still has like a dairy mouth feel
yeah,
to it.
It's not like
water. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a body to it for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's tangy, it's sour, but it's not like sharp and piercing. It's not like lemon juice.
Right.
You know, it still has like a smoothness to it.
Right.
Ooh, I like it. And I see the label, it doesn't say whey.
Right.
It says probiotic tonic.
Right. I feel terrible about that, actually. I do. I feel like I'm just like my mom when she was like trying to make me eat like liver and she like covered it up with like sauce. Also, like, do you not see my desperation like screaming through all this? Like, this is so good. Like,
call me whatever you want to. Yeah, just take me.
Yeah. Call me. Totally desperate. And so this is the idea in making it more familiar, making it more accessible.
Yeah.
And it's funny, this is a total tangent, but like as an immigrant, I'm kind of also a little resentful to that process because I'm like, I don't want to make myself familiar to you. I don't want to make myself accessible to you. Like, this is who I am. I'm this weird, unaccessible, unfamiliar thing. Like, that's just who I am.
Yeah, let me be me.
Let me be me.
And come see
and like
what I'm worth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think that's why I was a little resistant to that. And then I was like, oh, I'm gonna snap out of it and like make it accessible. Like, don't be weird. Don't like get all like French existential about this. Like, you know, and then we came up with a line of popsicles.
Yeah.
And we're using like the sour cherry juice from our leftover preserves to mix with the whey popsicles.
Yeah.
And we're, you know, like the idea of the popsicles is entirely like salvage oriented. And you know, like, whereas like White Mustache gets its reputation for being in these beautiful glass jars, like this was thought out because of like I was trying to be environmentally sound, yes, but it's also being kind of cheap because like what's more recyclable than taking this jar back and like steam cleaning it and reusing it? Like I can actually recycle this stuff. And that went into the idea of the popsicles too, because we wrap them in these like nostalgic like tubes, which might seem counterintuitive because it's not very like gourmet oriented, but like it uses almost like 50% less plastic than a traditional popsicle does that you have to wrap up and package and stuff.
Right.
So like those are things that we try to do and that inform like our entire kind of product line.
Yeah.
But it's exhausting. And it's exhausting like to explain, but it's also exhausting because you just get it wrong so many times. You know,
sure.
Like we're still putting our popsicles in a plastic tube. You know, like that doesn't make it full. Our caps are made out of plastic. There's so much energy that goes into like pressing one mold of glass. You know, like you just, like these thoughts are almost like paralyzing. But we've, you know, I think we've done really good work in terms of just getting ourselves out there. Like it hasn't translated into sales. It hasn't translated into like a market for the whey or even other yogurt companies doing it. But I just think something like this does take time and I'm willing to like give it that. So we've moved this process along about as slowly as it takes to make us a batch of yogurt.
So. Thank you, Homa. This is amazing.
Thank you so much for coming.
Homa Dashtaki is the founder of White Mustache. Coming up, the French and their complicated relationship with Le Doggy Bag. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. As Americans, we get a lot of our restaurant culture from France. I mean, the word restaurant itself comes from French, but there's one thing we definitely did not get from them, and that is the doggy bag. Here's Judith Kogan with a report on the many reasons restaurants in France and their customers have a hard time warming up to taking home leftovers.
French restaurants produce 1 million tons of edible waste annually. In a national poll, 75% of French people agreed that letting diners take food home is a good idea. The French Hospitality Association has encouraged restaurants to pack up leftovers for diners who ask for it. But the French can't seem to ask for or offer it.
La mentalité française, c'est comme ça.
The French mentality is that way. They prefer to throw it out.
I'm talking to Rosa, an employee of a Parisian Starbucks.
C'est possible de...
It's possible to offer a doggy bag, but many restaurants just say they don't want to.
Rosa asked Michael, the man standing next to her, what he thinks.
If you are paid for your food, if you are not finished in the restaurant, for me it's logical you can take the rest at home or at your office.
Restaurants have told Michael it was impossible.
J'ai eu comme excuse.
I've heard the excuse they didn't have a box or bag.
Of course, I want to know why they would make such an excuse. To understand the French resistance to le doggy bag, you need to understand a bit of French history and culture. The first thing the French like to point out is that portions are smaller in France than in the United States, so it's easier to clean your plate. And if food is left over, you wouldn't want to draw attention to it.
For the French people, it's impolite to us to take the food home, because you are not supposed to eat everything in your plate at the moment.
I'm at Yam Cha, a Michelin-starred Chinese-French fusion restaurant, speaking to the manager, Yohan Gregory.
At some point, most of people of the family, like grandparents and everything, they had a period where there are mostly nothing to eat. If you take something in your plate, you have to finish it.
For the restaurant, the doggy bag raises quality concerns.
The taste will be different, the texture will be different, and also the organic things won't be very good.
And there are health concerns.
We are not supposed to guarantee the quality of the product when it's out of our place. If the people will be sick afterwards, if they are eating our food 2 or 3 days afterwards, it will be our fault, which is not good at all for us.
But this is a Michelin-starred restaurant. Of course they're concerned with exacting standards. Is it any different at bistros, the most common place to dine? I stopped by Bistro Paul Bert, a classic French bistro and one of Paris's most popular. The moment you open the door, the sounds and smells of the bistro envelop you. Over 3 cozy rooms decorated with white tablecloths and bohemian accents, the sold-out dinner crowd is treated to a highly ritualized preparation and presentation of food and drink.
Would you like some water? And would you like some wine?
The bistro offers the classic French menu, described by its genial owner, Bertrand Aubonneau.
French meal, it's one appetizer, entree, one main course, cheese and dessert.
It's been this way for generations.
When I was a kid, my father was a banker. We had a cook at home and all that. My father couldn't think about a lunch or a dinner with less than 4 courses. It was just incredible. Impossible.
Even in remote parts of France, laborers who break for lunch tuck into 3-course lunches. And the French don't snack much between meals. They come to meals hungry. At Bistro Paul Bert, portions are big. Aubonneau is practical and forward-looking.
We are not used to take something out of the restaurant. We are not used to even to ask for it. But today, a lot of foreigners, when we do Côte de Bœuf or something like that, which is very huge, a lot of people say, could have a doggy bag for the meat, and we do it with no problem. And I hate waste, so for me it's very intelligent to do that.
He stocks plastic containers, but allows only certain foods to be taken home.
If it's fish, I always say no. Sometimes I say no because we're in summer, they're going to put that in the car, it's 35 degrees, I don't know where they're going, so I say no. I agree more on meat than on fish, and I agree more when they don't have too much sauce.
The chef sends it home with instructions.
The name of the plate, and he always put, please put it in the fridge, please not more than 2 days.
His French diners never ask to take food home. For them, food is inseparable from the whole dining out experience. But there's something else.
It's always a problem of shame with friends and all that. Why are you taking that home?
The French fear of looking poor by asking for a doggy bag may have roots in the 19th century.
There was a tradition of selling leftover food from higher tables, meaning tables in fancy restaurants, tables in wealthy homes.
That's Harvard French professor Janet Beiser, whose article, Why the French Hate Doggy Bags, published in the journal Contemporary French Civilization, inspired this report.
It would be sold either to the very poor, because they couldn't do any better, or to the not completely destitute, who could have the illusion of being a little bit wealthier by eating nice leftovers, like lobster claws, or some kind of dish like chicken marengo that had a fancy name.
Sometimes people buying this food invented stories.
They would say, this is for my dog, or this is for my cat, and then take it away, wrapped in newspaper, and eat it themselves.
In contemporary France, the mere name for restaurant leftovers is problematic. Le doggy bag not only suggests animal feed, it comes from America. Here's French journalist Marie Dugontès.
Just this cultural funny thing that really make America to the eyes of French people, exactly like hot dogs, like yellow cabs or baseballs.
The French tried rebranding Le Doggy Bag. They created a chic design and called it Le Gourmet Bag. That didn't help. Rosa and Michael are still at Starbucks.
Maybe it's gonna change, but I think it's gonna take several years or maybe decades. Because of the mentality and the fact that the ecology, it's not one of us priority in France.
C'est dommage, c'est triste, c'est malheureux.
Opoano says that in France, eating at home is changing. But in restaurants, the rituals persist. The French restaurant seems to be something of a theater or sacred space. You don't tamper with the traditions. You go with friends or family, indulge, and leave. With senses tingling and hands empty.
Judith Kogan is a Boston-based public radio reporter and a big fan of leftovers. Okay, we've been talking about food waste this episode, but the other thing that a lot of cooks think about is how much plastic we toss in our kitchens. And Sally Swift went to Lisa McManus, America's Test Kitchen's director of product testings, to see how we can replace plastic wrap and baggies with reusables.
Hey, Lisa, so great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
I want to talk today about a green kitchen, and I guess I really want to start with my guilty question, which is, when have we reused a plastic bag enough? Like, is it two times? Is it three times? Is there a moment when we can feel guilt-free that we've done our best, do you think?
Unfortunately not. I mean, it's always best to reuse it as many times as you can. And you can wash and dry bags and reuse them a bunch of times if you have them already. But our whole purpose now is to not introduce more new plastic into our kitchens, into our lives, because plastic never biodegrades. And we've learned this the hard way. It breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces. Fish eat them. We eat the fish. It's just coming full circle. And we everyone wants that to stop.
Mm-hmm. That documentary Blue Planet certainly drove that home for us. Okay, so let's talk about what have you guys found that you like to take the place of plastic wrap?
Well, we started thinking about ways people use plastic wrap, and one is to cover things in the microwave. And, you know, it has that awful problem of it, like, kind of blowing up and then sucking down onto the food, and, you know, and it's that seems sort of nasty. So we like to use a reusable silicone lid. You can also use a plate if you have one that's a handy size, but these are great because they don't get hot and you can use them over and over again. They come in different sizes. And the one that we like the best is Rachel Ray Top This Silicone Lid Set. It comes in three different sizes. And the cool thing about it, it looks just like a flat disc with a little knob on top. When you put it on top of the bowl and push it down a little bit, it actually suctions onto the bowl, whether it's metal or glass or ceramic. And when you could actually pick the bowl up with it, it sticks on that well. So you can use it in place of a wrap in the fridge or, you know, if you're transporting it to a potluck or something. And in the microwave, you can just put it down loosely. You don't really want to seal it up super tight, but, you know, it's fine, and it will get everything nice and warm without actually using up another sheet of plastic or even paper towel. It's just something you can wash and reuse for years.
Right, and there's a little bit of trust involved with those lids because you do wonder if they're really going to hold, but they're pretty good when they clamp on.
Yeah, we put like a cup of soup or water in, and we turn the bowls, and these did not leak. They were leak proof. Yeah. I wouldn't put it in your purse and carry soup for lunch, but like, you know, a little bit of sloshing as you're putting it into the fridge or whatever is not going to be the downfall.
All right, and so what about all of this? I guess they're cloth-based, plastic-coated kind of wraps. There's one that's made with wax.
Yes.
What have you discovered?
We've tested beeswrap, which is it's a cloth, and it's full of beeswax. And the wax is naturally waterproof, and it bends around food using the warmth of your hands. So it's kind of nice. And it smells really good. It has a faint sort
really
of
good.
Honey, waxy smell. And you can reuse it a bunch of times. They make it in all different sizes, including a big one to wrap bread, which is nice because when you wrap bread, like if you buy some nice crusty baguette and you put it in a plastic bag, it turns into rubber. It's really terrible. Like the moisture doesn't evaporate from it. It doesn't harden up like steel bread, but you get this sort of like tough rubbery quality to the bread. But something like beeswrap or even wax paper keeps that nice crispness on the surface and yet keeps enough moisture in. It's sort of a balancing act.
Can we talk about wax paper? Because I am a huge fan of wax
paper.
Me too. How do you guys feel about it? Yay!
Yeah, sometimes the old solutions are the best. You know, it's paper. It's got a little wax on it. You can't microwave it because that's going to melt the wax off it. But anything short of that, you can wrap. I wrap my son's sandwich to take to school every day in it. And, you know.
He doesn't shame you.
He does. No. I mean, you know, it's. I think all the kids are way ahead of the parents in this stuff. They know and they are concerned. And, you know, it's their earth they're going to inherit and all that. And they're more aware.
Right. Okay. And speaking of sandwiches, what do we do about sandwich bags? How are the reusable ones stacking up?
Well, we did test them. We have one that we kind of like. It's not perfect. None of them so far are really perfect. But we have one by Blue Avocado that we like. And it's got a gusset at the bottom, which means that it, you know, sort of triangular shaped when you open it. There's a little space for something like a tall sandwich. Some of these are like flat as pancakes. And you try to put a sandwich in and it just squashes it and it's awful. And they're kind of a pain to zip and unzip. But we were looking for something that would really take the place of your zipper lock bag. These work pretty well. We did run into some that just didn't come in good shapes or weren't leak proof. You know, if you do have a drippy tomato or something in your sandwich, it's not going to get all over the place, and it's washable. It also opens nice and wide, so when you wash it and try to dry it, you're not running into that problem where it's forever wet, and that can be kind of annoying and drive people back to those disposable bags.
Exactly. And what are they made? What are the good ones made of? Because you can get them in vinyl or silicone. Is that, are those the two options?
Yep, we actually liked the vinyl ones better. They sealed more tightly, and they, you know, they were nice. They had a nice texture to them. The only thing is that they do tend to look used a little faster than the silicone ones, which are pretty indestructible. But, I mean, if you're not concerned about it not looking pristine, they work and they keep working for quite a while.
Okay. And then last but not least, let's talk about compost buckets, because how do you evaluate a good compost bucket?
Well, you know, there's sort of a balancing act between something that's big enough to be useful, but not so big that you've got too much going on in there and it's staying in there too long and you have to use it, you know, or something too small where you're changing out the bag all the time. We got one that's a nice medium size. It sits on your counter. You know, that's the other thing. People put it on their counter so they can use it when they're cooking and they don't want it to look terrible. So that's a
or
factor.
Or smell.
Yeah, or smell. And so, you know, we looked at all these different factors as, you know, we tried to cook and put scraps in them and see how they held up and how easy they were to, you know, change the bag or to wash out if they didn't use a bag, because they have the biodegradable plastic liners that you can use. In fact, the city I live in, gave everyone a compost bucket and a couple of rolls of those bags to get us started, and they pick up the compost once a week. So I love that. So I didn't need to buy our winner, but if your town isn't yet there, we have one. It's called the Exaco Trading Company 2.4-gallon kitchen compost waste collector, and it's E-X-A-C-O, Exaco.
Hey, Lisa, great to talk to you. Thank you for your wisdom in our green kitchen.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus directs all the product testings at America's Test Kitchen, and you can find her recommendations for reusable wraps and bags at splendidtable.org. And that is our show for the week. We hope we didn't waste your time. Dad joke number one. And we'll see you next week. Be sure to go to splendidtable.org to get information on anything you ever hear here. Look around our recipe collection, register for a weekly email newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcasts at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our associate producer. Chip Walton is our digital producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Special thanks this week to Dan Powell and Sarah Bruguer for the recordings. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.